America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. What do you talk to your doctor about? Well, of course, I know you talk to your doctor about your health, but what else? I know with my doctor, we talk sports, we talk politics, and a range of things. But I must say that one thing we really don't discuss is money. And perhaps that's because he knows what I've done for a living. He knows that I don't have financial problems, perhaps in the way that some of his other patients do. But does your doctor talk to you at all about money? Now, you might say, well, why should he or she talk to me about money? Well, when you think about it, certainly we have not stripped the idea of money out of our concerns about our healthcare system. It is front and center about our ability to deliver services for all Americans. So you would imagine that if someone is recommending that you take certain prescriptions or have certain procedures, they would want to know whether you're capable of following through for your own health. Well, that's the topic that we explore today, one that you've probably not thought a lot about, but it makes a whole lot of sense. Thanks for joining us on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Dr. Michael Stein, and he's written a book called Broke: Patients Talk About Money with Their Doctor. Now, that seems an unusual topic, Dr. Stein, particularly given that in the book you say that for many years as a primary physician, you never talked about money with your patients.
I was trained not really to talk about money, that it wasn't really part of the social history of my patients, and even social history was far below the list of symptoms and immediate complaints of patients. And what I found was that over the years as a primary care doctor, that people who I came to know began to speak to me about money, sometimes money as directly related to their medical care and sometimes related to the wider ailments of their lives, right? Their alimony payments and their funeral costs that they had and car payments, and they started to talk to me about those things. And then I came to realize that, you know, these were things that affected their health in many ways, mental health as well as physical health, and that it should be part of a doctor's conversation. So when I wrote Broke, I really tried to assemble about 150 or so of very short sayings or conversations with patients of mine that all had to do with money. And those conversations are sometimes very immediate, and sometimes they're very poignant, and sometimes they speak to issues that are deep in their lives. So it became part of my conversations with people that I knew.
Absolutely. And I've got to tell you, in our society, and you said it in a very interesting way, money really is the currency of choice. And you said in America, America is money. America is an invoice. And I thought that was very interesting because some people can pay it, and some people can't pay it. And of course, the stories in your book are so poignant, even though they are grammatically incorrect. They are just pronouncements of pain and suffering that so many people are feeling, the inability paycheck to paycheck to make things work. And yet medicine is one of those areas that we know bankrupts so many people, and yet it's so foundational to someone living a good life and being able to enjoy all the other things they really want to spend money on.
Health is the means to a good life for many people, and at times when people are not in good health, and health is really different from healthcare, and maybe we'll come back to that, but at times when when they're not in good health, they come into a medical care system, which is, in my instance is a medical office, and they talk to me about their most immediate problems. And, you know, in our country, as you started here and as I wrote, it is invoice, right? That medicine has become this transactional piece, particularly in outpatient offices where people stop at a front desk and they meet somebody who asks them for an insurance card and a copayment. And it starts with money. And even though the doctor visit piece is removed from that, it is part of the sort of general encounter of any of us going to see our doctor. And it's not necessarily like that everywhere. And of course, money buys access to lots of things in America, and it buys access, unfortunately, to healthcare in many instances, since we don't have a universal coverage. Everybody's sort of the piece of to seek care exactly when they think they need it.
Now, you say that the front desk handles money, and that generally is where we do interact with our insurance, if we have insurance. And of course, I think you bemoan in the book that it's all tied to employment. And I'd love to have your overall reactions to the way we do it in America, which is different than just about anywhere else in the world. But should a doctor understand more? And do many doctors understand much about what the patient is dealing with when they do come through that door? For example, I mean, do you understand insurances well? Who has access? Medicaid expansion, where you practice? I mean, are these things that are really known to the doctor?
There are many parts to that question. One question is, what do doctors know about sort of the healthcare system in general? Another is, what do they know about price? And another is, what do they know about the healthcare system and price in their particular area? And I think doctors become quite expert about their particular area and how to maximize money. They might do it. Their office staff may do it. Remember, more and more doctors, and the majority of doctors now in America, work for large organizations, right? They're not mom-and-pop offices anymore. The small family physician rarely exists outside of rural areas these days. And so doctors are very aware of money and how it affects their immediate interactions with the patients who they choose to know. Now, what doctors know about Medicaid expansion in their state or nationally, what opinions they hold is a separate issue. How doctors are taught about money and the costs of care is a separate issue, and probably more advanced than when I went to medical school some decades ago. This comes up more and more. But certainly the topic of money comes up in all sorts of ways around prescriptions, right, which is a particularly overpriced part of American care, and is one where the doctors will often, you know, really interact with their patients when patients don't fill prescriptions because they don't have the money for it, or when a pharmacy calls the doctor back and says, can we find a cheaper alternative to this particular medication, et cetera. So at those points, doctors become acutely aware of their patients' financial situations. And my notion in the book, and through the voices of the people in the book, I let them, my patients, talk indirect ways that money affects their health.
Are you really somebody that they trust, at least initially, because you point out in the book, they look at you and they think you don't understand the circumstance they're in. You're a doctor. You're rich. You make a lot of money. So how do you break down that wall?
Well, the truth is I don't understand the situation that they're in, as we don't understand most other human beings' situation until we're curious about it. So the way to break down this, the doubt about my authenticity of understanding and whether I care, is for me to demonstrate that I'm curious and for them to offer up information that allows me to pursue the things that I think are important to them and too important to my care of them. And of course, that doesn't happen on a first appointment, right? If I've never met you before and you come in and see me with a sore throat, I don't typically go into, you know, deep financial conversations with you. I may, in fact, touch finance even in that simple visit around, if I give you a prescription, sir, will you be able to pay for this prescription? And if not, how are you thinking about filling this? Because this is going to be 10 days of treatment and it could cost this amount of money. And let me make sure that you understand that and that your insurance will cover that. So it may come up even in that very particular and narrow sense of cost. But in general, of course, new patients I don't talk about these things with, and I let them open up more naturally.
And you ask them what the trade-offs are. By that I mean, if they say to you, no, that's well too expensive, I'm now only working part-time, I got laid off because of the pandemic. Do you ask them what the trade-offs are? Is food going to go wanting? Are you going to be able to pay your rent? I mean, do you dig into those kinds of issues that are so much related to somebody's health and well-being?
It depends. It's a great question, and it really depends on whether I'm going to see them again or how much I'm going to see them again. So the trade-off that you're talking about, which are very common, do I buy these prescriptions or do I buy my son's prescriptions for his asthma? Do I take my prescription or do I get food for the next week? You know, these are real trade-offs in people's lives who have low incomes. And I typically don't go into that. I simply say, you know, I'm going to give you this prescription, and if you get to a pharmacy and the pharmacy gives you a price for the prescription and you can't afford it, please, you know, have them call me back immediately so we can make sure that you get an antibiotic that works for you at this particular time in as cheap a way as we can. And if they say, listen, I can't afford any medication for this, that would be somewhat unusual for somebody to say that who's also come into a doctor's office. But they may say, listen, I may have to borrow from my cousin for this, or, you know, I'm unlikely to take the full prescription because I can only afford 3 days worth, et cetera. So it comes out in very refined ways as you dig a little bit. But I don't typically go into life trade-offs with somebody I don't know, of course.
It's interesting. Years ago, I was a programming executive for a PBS affiliate, and we did a documentary called They Never Asked About My Drinking. And it was about how somebody would go into a hospital and perhaps they had been burned because a cigarette was left smoldering overnight and there was a fire related to it. But if they weren't asked what was really at the core of all of this, they wouldn't dig and they wouldn't find that it was drinking. And drinking, I think at that time, the number was something like 60%. Of the admissions in these hospitals, if you really dug very deep to the core, that's what you find. And money would seem to be one of those issues, too, that if you really looked at a person who's not sleeping, as you point out in the book, or is really stressed, at root is their insecurity about money or their ability to figure out how they are going to provide for the basic needs or even the nutritional needs that they might have.
Yeah, so you're again asking so many good questions and with so many layers. So there are lots of things that doctors have been studied. There are lots of research studies showing that doctors don't ask about, right? They don't ask about substances used, as you said, your drinking example. Doctors are very disinclined to talk about sex in general, and they really don't talk about money particularly. So we know that there are areas that unless the doctor is sort of vigilant and aware of their sort of patterns of asking, or in some cases that there are questionnaires that the doctor doesn't even have to ask. They could be on the table or filled out by a patient before they come in, and then the doctor hopefully would review that information. Many of these topics get glossed over. So we know that doctors miss a lot in busy office practices. And also, it's not just because they're busy. It's because the answers to these are sometimes hard to hear, and the doctors may not have so much to offer. Now, money is one of those things where I believe, and I teach my students, that it's worthy relatively early on with patients, and all patients really, to ask a very broad open-ended question such as, you know, at the end of the month, you know, are you able to make ends meet? And that gives a person an opportunity to talk about, I don't have money, trade-offs between food and paying my utility bills, et cetera. So a very open-ended, I would say one more thing about this is that, you know, we have this mythology in America, I think it's a mythology, that Americans don't like to talk about money, right? That in our personal lives, we don't tell our children what our paychecks are. We don't brag about money in lots of situations where we're more comfortable talking about probably even addiction and politics than money. But I've actually found this to be a sort of class divide, right? That working class people I know and take care of, they don't hesitate to talk about their income and their rent and their expenditures. And it's probably because, you know, when money is tight, people are thinking and talking about it incessantly, right? And so why not, if they're given even the slightest opening, they'll talk to you about their costs and what they can afford and the challenges and the possibility of living and paying all their bills. You know, I think working class people really have this on their mind a lot. If you have a lot of money, maybe you're embarrassed to talk about it, and so you don't want to talk about it in a public space. But I haven't found that in my patients who are primarily low income people in my town.
Do you think that most people understand, for example, you point out in the book that the official poverty rate is ridiculously low in comparison to the way that we have put it on a scale over the years, only adjusting for inflation, and that in fact 43% of the children in America live in poor families, and that half of Americans before they're 65, you point out, will, you know, below the poverty line at some point. Do you think that Americans who don't have to deal with these issues day to day really understand this?
No, I don't think people understand this at all if you don't fall into that half of the population who is thinking about it, right? I mean, I think that we don't want to think about people who are worse off than we are, and we don't go out of our way to find out about them. I mean, it is, of course, the trick of writing a book called Broke, right? Who's going to read a book called Broke? If you don't have money, you're not going to buy the book. And if you have money, really, are you going to buy a book about people who don't have money? Is that what interests you? You know, do you want to spend time with people who are not like you if you have money? And that's a decision for all of us. And there's morality in that decision. There's curiosity and there's time, et cetera. But, you know, these rates of poverty that we're talking about, you know, are really, when you present them to people, you know, quite shocking, right? That so many children, that one in five children in America live in poverty right now. And that rate is so unique among other high income countries like ours, like our peer nations. It is nowhere near that. And that there should be an understanding that really that is a public choice, right? That this is a political choice. And even though politicians will say, of every party will say, you know, I'm in favor of equal opportunity, and of course I don't believe the children are responsible for poverty, they allow poverty at really quite severe levels to affect one in five children in America. And there are ways that politicians and policymakers can change these numbers, but they don't. And so the notion of a book like Broke is really to make us aware of how prevalent this is and how meaningful it is in people's lives. I also want your listeners to understand that, you know, there's nothing, the book is not meant to be sentimental, that there are plenty of people who I see who don't have a lot of money, who I see in my office, who are doing just fine, right? They love the work they do. They love their families. They love their church. They don't particularly want that much more money. So, you know, there's a heterogeneity among low-income people as there is among all sorts of people. But I think that we have to understand that the rates of poverty in America are really quite stunning. On the other hand, you know, when you think about the rest of the world, they're stunning as well, right? Our poverty is relative. Even though we have a very high rate of poverty, you know, 75% of Americans have a car, and higher percentage than that own a color TV. So, you know, it's different from the worst parts of the low-income countries that we know about. But still, when you see it and when you see people lined up at food banks, you understand how much poverty there is. And we've seen a lot of that over this last year.
I do want to talk to you about the pandemic and what that has revealed. You're also a professor of health, law, policy and management at Boston University. So you look at it as a clinician, and you look at it as somebody who's very well schooled in public health. And I thought one of the things that you said was so interesting. You said, and by the way, you did say that one of the jobs of a primary physician is to listen. And I've got to tell you, I mean, I love my primary physician, but listening is sometimes an occasional thing. I mean, luckily, I've been in pretty good health, so I think he's taken it for granted, and he's been there when I needed him. But the point is that oftentimes my picture of my primary care physician is with his hand on the doorknob, getting ready to leave, just as I might reveal something about my health, because my intuition tells me I know a lot more about my health and what I'm telling, revealing, and what I'm hiding than he'll ever know until he finds it in the blood work. And if I don't want to reveal it until then, I won't. But I want to ask you, you say if you listen to patients one by one, they will tell you something about our society. What have they told you about America?
Well, I want to go back before we talk about America to your position, which is that, you know, I really am avid about this, which is, to me, you know, time is kindness. And that equation has fallen apart in the medical setting. And there is lots of unkindness in the medical setting, and there's lots of obliviousness of doctors in the medical setting. And I think a lot of that has to do with this sense of time, and that we don't have a lot of time to see patients. And, you know, for patients, having been a patient myself, you know, seeing a doctor is never a casual encounter, right? We're always anxious about it. It's always a bit of an invasion into our private lives and our bodies. And when you're not well, when you're vulnerable, when you're most alone with your body's betrayal, these visits hold really great power over us. And to me, you know, kindness is never more precious than when your quality of life has been disturbed or is about to be horribly deranged. And doctors hold our lives and our well-being in their hand, and being gently handled, which includes being asked about ourselves, is what we hope for, and I don't think we should ever put that aside as a too big an ask. And if you have doctors who are not kind and not spending that time with you, I suggest you move on, because eventually that's going to come back to haunt your relationship with that person. Okay, So that's my speech about doctors who need to spend time on this. And let me go back to your larger question. So what do they tell me? They tell me a bunch of things, right? About America. They tell me that America is hard, right? That there's lots of lousy housing, and that there's lots of lousy food, and they don't have a way that they can figure out how to get around this. You know, I have less opportunity than my parents did, which is true. And that, you know, how can it be that two adults working two full-time jobs each, so that's about 75 hours a week at the minimum wage, how can I really not have enough money to feed, clothe, and house my two children and my spouse and I? I mean, and those are just the realities of life in America at our minimum wage, and life is hard. And poverty, as I've described in the book and other places, in the few places where I write about this, is really, to me, a feeling, right? We get stuck on it as policymakers, as a dollar figure or a Medicaid threshold, as we've talked about already. But for a patient, for a person, it's a feeling, right? It's a feeling that I should be a little bit ashamed in this culture. I'm worthless. I'm a bit invisible. Don't ask me too many questions about money, because it's just going to make me more anxious. I feel like I'm missing out on things. So, you know, they tell me both sort of the facts of the world and what minimum wage is like, and they tell me what their feelings are. You know, my job, I'm lucky enough to have two jobs, right? I'm a primary care doctor, and I'm also a person interested in health policy. And I try to move back and forth between those two at the sort of personal, emotional level. I need to be compassionate. And at the policy level, I need to say, these are problems that we can solve and should solve, and that money lays at the sort of base of health in America, unfortunately. If you live in the poorest county in the United States, which was last year in South Dakota, the life expectancy of somebody there is 64 years old. And if you live in among the richest counties in America, let's say in Virginia, your life expectancy is in your early 80s. So between the poorest and the richest counties, that is where you're living, there is an 18-year difference in your life expectancy. I mean, that is a shocking number, you know, just based on income. And so income has lots of tentacles in people's lives, but to give up 18 years of it because you're poor seems tragic.
The social determinants of health, I hadn't heard that descriptor until about a year ago when I did a podcast on it. And I'd be curious for your reaction, because we are starting to talk about it today. We look at the very difficult situation that so many people have found themselves in during this public health pandemic of COVID-19 because of their living conditions, because of their frontline worker status, because they already live in polluted and forgotten places in America. Tell me how you look at that, put on your public policy hat, and is America beginning to wake up to this?
So COVID has brought our attention, as you said, to many of the conditions that we live in. And these are what social determinants or social drivers of health in the current parlance, right? Right? Safe housing, good schools, livable wages, clean air, drinkable water, et cetera. And those are all absolutely important things. And I'll just give you a sort of metaphor for this, for those of your fans and listeners who enjoy soccer. Okay, so my family has played soccer. Many people play soccer in America at this point. So I think of the difference between health, the social drivers of health, and health care. Health and health care are very distinct things. Health care in soccer is the goalie. You want a really good goalie when you're sick, when the other team is attacking you, and you want to protect your goal, your doctor is your goalie. They do not want that goal to come in. But the action of a soccer game takes place among the other 10 players facing off with the other opponent's 10 players in the middle of the field. And that's where health takes place. That's where public health takes place. That's where the social drivers take place. And the entire game is sculpted around what's happening in the field. If the other team actually has to see it, has to come near your goalie, has to come near a doctor, you have a problem. Right? You want to keep the ball and the game out in the field with your other players. So healthcare is the doctor. You do not want to bother the doctor. If you have to bother the goalie, you want a really good goalie. But the way to win the game is to win the game out in the health field. So the game is played out in the field, and 99% of your health is determined out under the conditions of the world that you live in. And a small part of the game, a small part of the soccer game, is when you come to see me in my office, when you come to visit the goalie. So the way to stay healthy and to stay away from doctors is to have control over the conditions of your life. And those are the preventive conditions that we need to maintain health. And as a country, as you know, and COVID has exploded this, we spend trillions of dollars on health care, and we spend a pittance of that, about 0.1% of our national budget, on public health. And it came to roost during COVID when we saw the problems in the public health system and the social drivers of health that was driving everybody into the healthcare system that buckled under the weight of a poor preventive health world.
Very interesting that you say in the book, as you close it, that you got a different perspective altogether on your patients as you began to undertake telemedicine in a rapid pace, as the entire industry had to speed it up in response to the pandemic. I know that I just did a podcast about self-neglect among the elderly. And the fact is that a gerontological doctor can take a look at a lot of things that are going on in a household and really determine where the lapse in health care and the impact on the health of an elderly person is really taking place. They're not taking their meds. They're surrounded by a lot of opportunity to fall, a whole range of things that if you can look in their home. And you're saying that you're getting a different perspective as a result of the pandemic as you are able to see into someone's home.
Yeah, I mean, in keeping with my last answer, again, health is driven by all of these aspects of a person's life outside the doctor's office, right? So, and sometimes the greater world and the water and the food that they drink and eat, and sometimes just the dangers within their house, particularly for elderly people, whether it's a loose rug or a dark hallway, right? So we get to see people's houses and homes and lives through these cameras of telehealth that have allowed us, for those who have video cameras and are showing us their homes, we're seeing the conditions that they live under, which is so important and so interesting. And there's sort of, you know, a common understanding in medicine that, you know, most of a diagnosis, some say 75%, some people say 90% of any diagnosis comes from the history. That you rarely have to touch somebody to really know the diagnosis, that you can have the history of symptoms and you can have the history of background and you can make a diagnosis of most people. And I think we've certainly seen that in telehealth. We can make many diagnoses on the phone, you know, beyond mental health diagnoses, which obviously you could always make on the phone or in a video camera, but certainly allowing us into one's home is a very intimate act and a way that we get a very good sense of a person's life.
You also say that the economics of empathy, who gets it, who deserves it, who is denied it, is complicated and brutal. Explain what you meant by that.
The economics of empathy is a phrase that I used to capture this sense of time again. That again, that kindness is about time, and that the economics of medicine works against us spending much time with people, and that that time is empathy, and time is not rewarded, or time spent with patients, or time spent talking and being curious is not rewarded in our current healthcare payment system.
When somebody comes into your office, and you obviously can tell that there are certain things lacking, perhaps it's their appearance, perhaps it's dental care, and they sit down in front of you and you want to assess their overall health. First of all, is there something that normally you would ask or something you would normally see as the first sign that there's perhaps some neglect going on in their lives because they just can't afford some of the necessities that others take for granted?
So I think that there's no universal sign of low income. I'm not a good judge of that. And until you can, I can figure out whether this person really is missing out on essential ingredients of self-care, I will have no way of being able to judge their income. What we know, though, as sort of as a general rule, and I apply this with an eye to an individual patient, would be that, you know, obesity is associated with low income. Now, in other countries, that's not the case, right? You have very little money and people don't eat at all and they're undernourished. In America, if you have relatively little money, you eat lousy foods and you put on weight because the most inexpensive foods are the most obesogenic. So obesity is a signal often of low income. As you said, teeth and self-care around dental care is often a sign for some people. Sleeplessness. Now, Americans are often sleepless for lots of reasons these days, and but that's a piece that, again, we know that people with low incomes have more trouble sleeping. Every chronic medical condition is likely to be exacerbated in people who have low incomes. And so they would have higher blood pressures and less adherence to medications that would lower their blood pressure. They might come in with sugars that are high if they have diabetes because they've been unable to afford insulin. So again, it's an awareness of the of some common elements that that might allow me to investigate a little bit further about, what's causing the problem that I'm seeing in front of me. In closing, healthy individuals, healthy society. There are so many times I'll hear a statistic about America where more of us are overweight. We're beginning to see a decline in our actual ages in terms of, mortality rate is going up at a younger age. We take a lot more prescription drugs than other societies. What does all of this tell us in combination about America? Is it that care is too expensive? Is it that we just don't focus enough on the needs of individuals and allow them to fall into poverty? What is it that it tells us when we hear these kinds of stories in the richest nation on earth?
Well, yes and yes to the two explanations that you offered. Yes, we spend too much on health care, not enough on preventive or public health. That's number one. Number two, as you said, poverty is a major driver of poor health in America, and we need to recognize that we have to invest in the preventive conditions of health in order to reduce, the entrenched health gaps, the inequitable health that we see across cities and across income levels in this country, and that we need to prepare even for the next pandemic. We'll be out of this pandemic at some point. Will we again collectively invest for the benefit of all for our next pandemic, which is certainly coming down the road? So I think that we need to have compassion for others. That's always at the heart of health, but we also need to call attention to the common good, and that, without health for most or all of us is in jeopardy.
Dr. Michael Stein has been our guest. The book is called Broke, and he gives voice to his patients as they tell their stories and reveal to us many intimacies about their life and the impact it has on their health. And I give you so much credit for your focus on this issue of money. I don't think there are too many doctors who do that. By the way, does anybody in your profession say, why do you bother with this? Or is it something that doctors talk to each other about?
Now, most doctors ask me why I bother to write books at all, let alone books about people with low income. So I don't know that there's general interest in this subject, but there's certainly a subgroup of people who are very interested in this. And the idea of, universally covering our population so that we all have access to the human right that we call care is central to the lives of many policymakers and many doctors. So,
well, I can't think of a better way to end our conversation today. It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Stein, for being with us.
Larry, thanks so much for having me.